Chief of Research here at the Elliott School, an Associate Professor of History and International Affairs, and I am delighted to welcome you to the launch of this book on nuclear debates in Asia, the role of geopolitics and domestic processes. Our very own Professor Deepa Alapalli, who's the Associate Director of the Seeger Center for Asian Studies, has been the moving force for years behind the Rising Powers Project. Last year she was given the Integrator Award at the Elliott School of helping to bring together different faculty on research projects. And this book is a fantastic example of it, and next spring they're going to have another book on energy security and rising powers. So they will have had three books in 5 years from this Rising Powers Project. The project has gotten funding from the Seeger Center, from the SOAR initiative by an anonymous donor to the Elliott School, as well as funding from the MacArthur Foundation and Carnegie, and the Center and Institute Facilitating Fund here at GW. So they've been really active in getting some great support for their work on important rising powers around the world. And today they're going to be talking about the particular issue of rising powers and nuclear debates, focusing on Asia. Before I turn it over to Deepa Alapalli, I just want to tell you about a couple of the wonderful reviews of this book so far. Bruce Blair at Princeton has said that for those of us struggling to understand and anticipate the future of nuclear energy and nuclear weapons programs in Asia, this timely book reveals the critical role played by domestic forces in the region. Its contributors know well the domestic scene that is driving nuclear outcomes in each of these countries. And they make a persuasive case that it's these internal forces that eclipse external geopolitical forces in shaping Asia's future. Vipin Narang of MIT writes about this book: "This must-read book assembles a veritable who's who of nuclear experts on Asia. They track the balance of nationalists, realists, and globalists in each country and analyze how domestic political configurations affect the nuclear policies of these Asian nations." So you're here for an important and exciting topic. I want to welcome Mike Mochizuki, Bob Sutter, who are also professors here, and particularly welcome Scott Snyder to the group. And with that, I will happily turn it over to Deepa.
Thank you, Hope, for those nice words. And also I want to thank the Elliott School for all their help from the Dean's offices and so forth for their support of the Rising Powers Initiative. As Hope said, it was a major project, this book. We have 13 authors, and at the end of co-editing, I think I can say that Mike and I are still friends. So, but it was only because our other authors were so incredibly responsive to all our requests for updates and meeting deadlines and so on. And so I want to thank all of my co-authors on this book for that. And I want to thank everybody who's my authors at the table, as well as two in the audience, Linda Yar and Tim Westmeyer. So, and I also see another former colleague who was very involved in helping us, Matt Grieger. Thanks to all of you. We all went to Hanoi for a conference on this book where we got to really spend some good times together too. Now, our book covers a large number of Asian states. China, India, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Vietnam, and Pakistan. They all have their own chapters, and then we have a chapter for Southeast Asia looking at ASEAN countries as a group. Now today, we're going to give you only a slice of the book. We decided that given the sort of high-level current interest in Northeast Asia and East Asia, and the challenges posed by yet another nuclear test by North Korea, that we would single out these countries from our book. So that for that, we are able to have Mike Mochizuki on Japan, Scott Snyder from the Council on Foreign Relations, he'll be looking at Korea, and then Bob Sutter, also a professor here, he is going to look at Taiwan, which is what he worked on, but given his expertise on China, and because he's such a good colleague, he's also going to talk about, he worked on Taiwan, and he's going to talk about China as well, because we couldn't get our Chinese author here. But a special thanks to Bob for stepping in on that. Now, before I turn to the other authors, what I do want to do is to spend a few minutes on why we wrote the book and lay out some of our key findings, overall findings for you all. So as many of you know, most of the studies on nuclear policies in Asia tend to follow conventional wisdom that a state's nuclear choices are determined by external security factors. In other words, you look at interstate competition and geopolitical rivalries, which are seen to be sufficient explanations for nuclear preferences. Now, there are analysts who disagree with this and argue otherwise, and they point to things like other domestic factors, such as political survival, bureaucratic compulsions, techno-military elitism, social norms, identity politics, and so forth. Now, we share the skepticism that strategic circumstances are sufficient to explain the choices that states make on nuclear weapons and nuclear energy. And so we join those who argue for the necessity of a domestic lens of analysis. So how do we bring the domestic lens in our work? What we do, we specifically look at the domestic debates, which is in the title of the book, and discourse on nuclear issues. So we ask the question, how can we understand the trajectory of nuclear energy, nuclear security, and nuclear nonproliferation discourse and debate in seven of these key Asian states? We wanted to see how the debates change over time, what drives these debates, and what the interplay is between the domestic and geopolitical calculations in the discourse, and then most importantly, where the center of gravity of debate lies in these countries. So how do we go about determining the center of gravity of these debates? Well, we used a framework that suggests that domestic debates are structured along three foreign policy schools of thought. We did this, laid this out earlier in a book, the first book that came out, World Views of Aspiring Powers. What we did in this book is in each of these chapters, we identified and then tracked the relative weight of nuclear nationalists, nuclear realists, and nuclear globalists in the debates over time. Now, I don't want to spend any time really elaborating these schools of thought, which I do in the book, but I thought I'd just give a quick shorthand definition. Nuclear nationalists, they want nuclear self-reliance and autonomy and kind of resist any restraints on capabilities, and they tend to see the world as hostile and very suspicious of non-proliferation efforts. And they also give a lot of weight to the symbolic importance of nuclear capabilities. Nuclear realists, they also see the world as hostile, but they see it as manageable. And they give priority to national security, and they tend to be characteristically sort of practical cost-benefit maximizers, and they think that hard-nosed negotiations can bring security-enhancing outcomes as well. And they want to get on the international great power scene, so they want to be part of the rule-setting environment, and so they do see the need for some kind of accommodation in the global sphere. Nuclear globalists, they favor measures that increase the integration of their country into non-proliferation efforts, and they are the most interested in involvement in safeguards, nuclear disarmament, and so forth. So, as I said, a key objective was to find the relative weight of these different nuclear views in these countries. So, let me just identify a few of our key findings. First of all, despite the diversity of the countries that we looked at, we found some common features across countries. But in all the cases that we looked at, decision-making on nuclear issues was on the whole an elite process. To the extent that there is some pluralism, it usually involved competition among agencies within the government system. And we found that this elitist character applied to both democratic and the authoritarian states. Another finding, after the Fukushima disaster, the techno-nationalist elite enclaves that we found in nuclear decision-making in many of these Asian states have weakened. This is especially true in Japan, but also Taiwan. There's a pullback thanks to civil society groups in Indonesia, Philippines, Thailand. Nuclear policymaking in India and South Korea have not been immune to this trend either. Regarding this relative openness and pluralization, Pakistan is the one outlier among the countries that we looked at. Fourthly, in virtually all of these countries, we found globalist, realist, and nationalist worldviews and discourse representative. Most importantly, we concluded that despite the widespread concerns about both horizontal and vertical non-proliferation, not non-proliferation, but proliferation in Asia, in every country except Pakistan, the center of gravity of domestic debates has shifted toward a realist or a realist slash globalist worldview. Only in Pakistan is nationalist discourse a primary driver of nuclear policy. This is quite remarkable finding, given the geopolitical suspicion that has accompanied the regional power transitions, especially the ascendancy of China, and the rise of so-called resource nationalism in the context of increasing demand for energy. So what it suggests is that nuclear policy is relatively insulated from the whims of populist nationalism. Now, notwithstanding these overall discourse trends, we did find important cross-national variations on how the different worldviews and discourses mattered on specific nuclear issues in each of the countries that we looked at. And we looked at three issues for most of them: nuclear energy, nuclear weapons, and nuclear non-proliferation. And finally, we found that the United States played an important role in shaping both the discourse and the policies of these Asian countries, which is something that needs to be kept in mind as we look in the future of U.S. policy toward Asia. And so with that, I'm going to now turn it over to my colleagues, who will give more details of the chapters. And I'll start with Mike and go down the line as we're seated. Thank you.
I want to join Deepa in thanking all of the people who made this project possible and supported it from the beginning to the very end. And many of the people who are not here, especially on this panel, are also mentioned in the acknowledgments of the book, and without their help, we could not have finished this project. What I'd like to do is to dig deeper into the Japanese case, and very much Japan represents, I think, this is the prototype of the argument that we make in the book about the importance of domestic politics and processes in shaping the nuclear policy in a specific country. And Japan very much fits that mode. What I'd like to do first is to situate my argument in the general debate or discourse about Japan, especially what we hear in Washington, D.C. Then secondly, just highlight three main arguments, and then finally end with some of the recent trends that are extension of the analysis in the book. First of all, my chapter very much cuts against kind of the prevailing discourse that one hears in the policy community. I mean, we often hear that with the North Korean nuclear program and the rise of China, Japan is feeling increasingly insecure. And because of this, the motivation for Japan to break out of its non-nuclear weapons policy is getting greater, and even someone like Vice President Biden would go to East Asia and basically try to convince the Chinese that this is what the Japanese might do if China does not step in and help solve the North Korean nuclear issue. So that's one argument that we often hear in Washington. A second argument is that Japan is engaging in real nuclear hedging, in part because it wants to strengthen the U.S. nuclear extended deterrence, and secondly, to encourage restraint on the part of regional actors. And then finally, a number of analysts point to evidence that this is in fact happening. They would say that the Constitution does not prohibit nuclear weapons, and so when a new political leader makes this statement, this is seen as some newsworthy event, although this kind of statement has been made since the 1950s. They also point to arguments made by some policy elites that Japan needs to maintain its nuclear energy program after Fukushima as a nuclear weapons hedge. And then others point out that Japan has been stockpiling plutonium. And why else would Japan stockpile plutonium except that Japan wants to have this nuclear option? So that's the general argument that we hear often in Washington, D.C. And there is some truth to that, especially the second point about a nuclear hedge. But I think even on the nuclear hedge point, it is exaggerated and overdrawn. And so my three main arguments is, first of all, the threshold for Japan to exercise the nuclear weapons option is very, very high. Now, one can conceive of a world in which Japan might cross that threshold, but the development of North Korean nuclear weapons is not enough. The rise of a Chinese military power is not enough. Maybe the election of President Trump might do that, but I would say that probably is not enough. And it's because of the pervasive public opinion against nuclear weapons, but on top of that, the presence of critical veto groups in the Japanese governmental machinery. Secondly, after Fukushima, the center of gravity of the debate, and this debate among globalists, realists, and nationalists have been in existence for decades. But what's most striking, in the course of my research, the striking finding was that the center of gravity has shifted to a kind of amalgamation of what I would call the nuclear realist and the anti-nuclear globalist. And despite the pro-nuclear nationalists, who want not only a robust nuclear energy program, but really exercise the nuclear weapons option and a strong hedge, despite those voices being very loud, they are very much in the minority. So in a sense, the trends are going in the opposite direction from the conventional view. And then finally, this is kind of historically based, but there is a fundamental bargain in Japan between nuclear energy and nuclear weapons. And many people dismiss the so-called nuclear allergy because Japan has had a pretty robust nuclear energy program. But it's precisely because of the allergy to nuclear weapons in the wake of Hiroshima and Nagasaki that there was a basic bargain that was struck between those who favored nuclear energy and those who were against nuclear weapons. And so if Japan was to promote nuclear energy, there had to be robust constraints on the development of nuclear weapons, and eventually it becomes enshrined in the famous three non-nuclear principles. Now that bargain, I think, continues, and it is reinforced by the global nuclear nonproliferation regime. But one trend is that I think if there is an ascendant view, it is what I call the nuclear double zero. It's not only no to nuclear weapons and being proactive in nuclear disarmament, but it's also no to nuclear energy. Okay, those are my kind of three main arguments. Now just let me close with some of the trends. And the government projections, or at least the forecasts or expectations, is that Japan will eventually revive its nuclear energy program so that about 20 to 22% of power will be generated by nuclear power plants. I see that as a very ambitious target. Given the resilience of opposition to this and the various legal and local political things that Japan can do to stop this, I think that even if there is a revival of nuclear energy, it is probably going to be in the 10 to 15% range. Now, the other thing which, you know, I found surprising is how robust the Japanese public support for the three non-nuclear principles are. And in fact, even as Japan's security environment has deteriorated, support for the three non-nuclear principles has increased. In 1988, it was 78%, and in 2014, 82%. But even more striking is that more people in Japan feel that the U.S. nuclear umbrella is unnecessary than those who feel that it is necessary. And in fact, the percentage of those that feel that it's unnecessary has grown over time, so that it is the plurality view. In terms of breaking out of the basic parameters of what I would call a non-nuclear weapons policy, I just don't see it. And so to the extent that the so-called realists want to deal with the security environment, the deteriorating security environment, is to move towards developing conventional capabilities, not nuclear capabilities, and strengthening the U.S.-Japan alliance. A second critical trend, you know, which I talk about in the paper, but we've seen extensions of this, is the Japanese attitude towards reprocessing and the full nuclear fuel cycle. And this has often been pointed to, that Japan has this nuclear hedge because it's got this reprocessing of program. But as we saw last month, you know, the Japanese are trying to walk away from its fast breeder reactor program because it has been terribly costly and they've had many, many problems for it. Now, the one constraint in full abandonment of this is not because Japan wants to exercise its nuclear hedge, but because they have a problem with nuclear waste. And they've made a bargain with localities that they would hang on to some of the nuclear waste, that under the condition that this would eventually go into the full fuel cycle. The disposition of nuclear waste is one of the key factors that even have mobilized conservatives in Japanese politics to be critical of nuclear energy. And the most celebrated kind of opponent of this is former Prime Minister Koizumi. Now, the final trend I just want to highlight is, because of the domestic constraints in Japan for the full development of nuclear energy and the revival of nuclear energy, the conservatives who are in favor of nuclear energy are now actively pursuing external markets for the sale of Japanese nuclear technology. The United States has an interest in the continued kind of operation of the Japanese nuclear industry. When the Democratic Party of Japan announced that eventually Japan would abandon nuclear energy, the United States came down hard because the United States also has a problem in terms of nuclear energy, and many of the nuclear energy industry representatives are now linked up with the Japanese nuclear industry. So what I see is it's an ironic situation is that Japan domestically is going to be even more constrained in terms of nuclear policy, but then Japan will be active in promoting nuclear energy in other countries. And this will then raise another policy problem, which we talk about in the book, about nuclear safety, nuclear security, and the proliferation risks of that. Thank you.
Scott?
Oh, I just wanted to, sorry, just want to remind that it is being recorded. I failed to mention that.
Now I have to be on my best behavior.
I could have said that.
First, I want to thank Deepa and Mike for inviting me to join this project. It has been very interesting. I'm actually looking forward to going through the entire compilation now that it's out. For me, I think one of the real attractions of being a part of the project was the opportunity to try to apply this framework, the realist, nationalist, and globalist framework to the evolution of debates over nuclear energy and nuclear weapons in South Korea. And in particular, to try to capture some of the interplay among the schools of thought the two sides of the debate on energy and nuclear weapons in the South Korean case. In my chapter, I really look at three particular sets of debates. One over nuclear energy, which was really about the drive for self-reliance in the decision of South Korea to acquire a nuclear energy industry with help from the United States. Second, debates in South Korea over the possibility of nuclear weapons acquisition, especially in light of North Korea's rising nuclear capabilities. And the third really revolves around issues of non-proliferation and spent fuel management in the context of the U.S.-South Korea renegotiation of the nuclear cooperation agreement that has just taken place in the last couple of years. And I think there are three sub-themes in these particular debates that really bear, emphasis. One is the role that the alliance ended up playing in each component of these debates, the relationship between South Korea and the United States. Second, South Korea has undergone a transition from authoritarianism to democracy, and so I think that's an interesting lens through which to think about these particular debates. And the third is the impact of South Korea's rising capabilities on the evolution of South Korean debates about nuclear energy. And so, when I went back and looked at the original origins of the South Korean nuclear program, it really was about South Korean realist desires to have energy self-sufficiency, aided and encouraged by American globalists who really wanted to promote peaceful use of nuclear energy. It's really that relationship that I think enabled the establishment of South Korea as a country that has developed a nuclear industry. But of course, in the 1970s, this particular capability related to peaceful use of nuclear energy took a strange turn. Because the then president, Park Chung-hee, tried to develop a secret nuclear weapons program. And this, I think, is an expression of the South Korean nationalist school under authoritarianism in the 1970s. And of course, that desire for nuclear weapons was really driven by the feeling that the U.S.-Korea alliance was weak. U.S. was involved with Vietnam. Park Chung-hee felt, in the context of the Nixon doctrine, that U.S. assurances may not be credible, and he faced a larger and more powerful North Korea. And so that was the nationalist driver in the 1970s. And of course, the alliance relationship also ended up being the trigger for the end of that effort by Park Chung-hee, when he was essentially faced with an ultimatum, either maintain the alliance or end your nuclear program, nuclear weapons program. And then later on, what we see is the nuclear energy sector being influenced by globalist thoughts, especially as South Korea became an exporter of nuclear energy in the 2000s. And so we can see this kind of evolution and the kind of rise of the globalist school, really, I think, in connection with South Korean rising capabilities. But there's a twist here that has been going on over the course of the past 10 years related to North Korea's nuclear program. And again, it highlights an aspect of the U.S.-Korea alliance, because the United States has a commitment to defend South Korea against a potential nuclear attack from North Korea. And so I like to think about the nuclear debates that we've seen in a democratic South Korea over the course of the past 10 years in a way as an indicator of the extent of assurance or doubt related to U.S. extended deterrence commitments. And here, I think what's interesting is that we saw the evolution of a South Korean debate. After each North Korean nuclear test, the debate has gone a little bit further. But the initial expression was a nationalist expression of a desire to have a nuclear capability. It actually started, interestingly enough, after the second North Korean nuclear test in 2009, not after the first North Korean nuclear test. We've also seen the emergence of a second position in the South Korean debate that kind of, it calls for the U.S. to return tactical nuclear weapons to South Korea. And I see that as a kind of realist expression. As I look at the direction of South Korean policy, even in the context of this latest set of two tests, which are not covered in my description of what happened simply because they happened this year, and so it was too late, but essentially what we see is enhanced discussion about nuclear acquisition, but I think really as an expression of frustration, especially about U.S. policy and, frankly, about Chinese policy. But obviously, this is active and ongoing in the context of what North Korea is doing. The third aspect or debate that I covered was really about the debate within South Korea about how to approach the U.S. On nuclear cooperation. And specifically, South Korea wanted to follow the Japan model and attain an enrichment and reprocessing capability. In some ways, the logic could be, well, if Japan is an ally of the United States and South Korea is an ally of the United States, then why doesn't South Korea deserve the same capabilities in terms, or trust, in terms of enrichment and reprocessing that Japan has? And so it was very interesting to watch this particular debate as it has unfolded. As you all know, a new cooperation agreement was negotiated, and I would say that the agreement was able to be made because of a shift from this nationalist desire for enrichment and reprocessing to an understanding of what would be needed in the globalist context of nonproliferation and South Korean rising commitments and responsibilities to contribute to the global nonproliferation regime. And one of the really significant, I think, elements of this shift that came out in the form of the new nuclear cooperation agreement was the establishment of a high-level bilateral committee between South Korea and the United States that would continue to focus on the main issues of South Korea's nuclear waste problem, fuel supply, and South Korea's desire to work with the United States more closely on exports. But what's most interesting to me about that bilateral committee, which is going to be overseeing the relationship going forward, and by the way, includes U.S. ROK cooperation on projects involving potential reprocessing issues, is that on the South Korean side, it's being led by the Foreign Ministry. On the U.S. side, it's being led by the Department of Energy. And so I see that as kind of the affirmation that South Korea is moving in the globalist direction, or at least the internal debate in the end is being managed by globalists as opposed to realists or nationalists within South Korea's bureaucratic context. I'll stop there.
Thanks. Bob, for your mega presentation.
Sure.
It's an honor for me to be part of this project, and I really thank our sponsors for permitting me to be part of it. What I plan to do is talk a bit about Taiwan, the article that I had a lot to do with, and then I have remarks as a reviewer of the very good article on China, which is written by Wei Zhang, and excellent credentials as an expert from Harvard, right?
Yes.
Harvard,
yeah. Yes.
So it's an excellent article. So Taiwan, I'm going to talk about three aspects as are the focus of the paper, that is development of nuclear weapons, the attitude toward that, the attitude toward non-proliferation, nuclear non-proliferation. And in Taiwan's case, it's particularly important because they're not in the UN. So they're not in part of these UN bodies that deal with the non-proliferation. So Taiwan's role there. And then then Taiwan's often active debates about nuclear power, and here, just a side point I should have mentioned earlier. In my article I was a co-author, and so the other author is from Taiwan. His name is Alvin Yao, who was a fellow here at the Seeger Center years ago, and is now with the Prospect Foundation. And I also want to thank TECRO, the Taiwan office here, for helping set up appointments and facilitating the trip. So it was really a very enjoyable trip. And the reason I mentioned this on the third category is because the first two, they're interesting topics and they're very important strategically, Taiwan developing nuclear weapons. I mean, that's very important. Of course, Taiwan tried secretly to develop nuclear weapons twice, not once, twice. And obviously they face an enormous challenge with the PRC. So we need to watch this carefully, right? Well, we're looking at this, and I think I came away with a very strong feeling that we don't have too much to worry about there, even if Donald Trump gets elected. I think Taiwan is just moving almost inexorably in a different direction. And then the second issue has to do with nonproliferation. And both of these issues, both the development of nuclear weapons and nonproliferation, are issues that are handled by elites, and they fit very nicely into the framework of nationalist and realist and globalist. And clearly, nationalist sentiment was into the fore when Taiwan was secretly developing its own nuclear weapons, very nationalist perspective. And that's basically over. And Taiwan is moving in a very different direction, and Taiwan wants to be nuclear free as a country, and they're moving in that direction, and so the capabilities, there are all sorts of reasons why developing nuclear weapons at this point is very unlikely. The elites obviously don't want it, and so I come away with a great deal of confidence that's going to take place. And then on the non-proliferation side, even though Taiwan isn't in the United Nations, they're very cooperative with the United States in working on these issues. And so the United States acknowledges them. They sort of get a gold star from the US government on their behavior in nuclear non-proliferation. So the elites there are clearly moving in the direction of being fully cooperative. And so I would have to say global outlooks, with the globalist, I guess, if you will, have prevailed over the nationalist sentiment in Taiwan. And it's realistic to do so, so it complicates it a little bit, but both of these meet Taiwan's interests. And the reason I was so grateful to have the support that I had in dealing with the issue, because I went to Taiwan for the interviews for this project in the middle of 2013, and that was right in the middle of the big nuclear debate on nuclear power in Taiwan. So it was a fascinating time to be there. And here I was seeing all sorts of sources of input into the project, and I said, are you nationalist? Are you globalist? and what I found, it was a mess. And this is inevitable in Taiwan. If you follow Taiwan politics and Taiwan developments, what you find is these upsurges of empowered people. And this was a good example. The next example happened in 2014 in the Sunflower Movement. These are not party-driven. These are people coming up because of the interest. And the interest here was basically safety. Are we going to have safety in Taiwan? And it caught the imagination of lots of people. And they got, I think it was 200,000 people to demonstrate in March of 2013 in Taipei. And so so here our framework didn't work very well because it became, there were a lot of cross-cutting currents. And so the upshot of this was that we had to look at this on its own. So unlike the elite-controlled debates on nuclear weapons and nuclear proliferation, very narrow scope of people involved, the nuclear power debate was wide-ranging. And this had a history in Taiwan. The history of nuclear power has been controversial in Taiwan. It was the first major issue faced by the DPP president, Chen Shui-bian, when he took power in 2000. The DPP is anti-nuclear. They don't like nuclear weapons. Nuclear power. And the issue has been for decades now, should Taiwan build a nuclear power plant, a fourth one? They have three. Should they build a fourth? And they eventually built it. And then they should they open it? That was the issue. So they spent all this money building this power plant, and by 2013 they didn't want it to open, and they were objecting to this on safety grounds. The background of this was, of course, Fukushima. That made them very concerned about this, and then they said, if the Japanese don't have their technology right, they said, well, jeepers, Taiwan is much more at risk here. You know, they saw the Japanese standards as much higher than their own, at least from the man in the street point of view. The ruling party at that time, the KMT under Ma Ying-jeou, the president, he favored nuclear power. His party wanted to move forward with the plant. They tried to move forward on this by proposing a referendum, and this caused an upsurge of antipathy, where these large demonstrations and so forth took place. The opposition party at that time, the DPP, felt that this was something that they were in sync with, and they tried to be supportive in this context.